Chapter 4. This parting was well made. These are they who have come out of the great tribulation. Revelation 7, verse 14. It woke me. The rain did. Usually rain wouldn't wake me. Usually rain would soothe me into a deeper sleep. A sleep so deep that when I wake, I feel myself pulled up out of a bottomless well. That's how I felt now, except I also felt jolted. I'd been pulled up too quick. It was the slow, heavy tap, tap, tap of the rain. This time was different from the other times with rain. This time it woke me. The rain did. I came out of the bedroom, went down the hall to the bathroom, and then walked out into the living room. I found her sitting in her recliner. "Hey, Mom, how you doing?" I said. I bent over and kissed her on the cheek. "Doing fine, Robert. You hungry?" "Yes, ma'am. I was thinking about making a couscous for breakfast. You want some?" "A couscous? Breakfast? It's kind of late in the day for that, don't you think?" "What time is it, Mom?" "It's 6:15, Cher. Your daddy just drove over to your sister's house for a while." 6:15 in the evening? I slept the whole day?" "I was worried, Robert, but your daddy said I should let you sleep. He said you was probably just tired from your work and traveling." I couldn't believe that I had slept the whole day away. I sat down in Daddy's recliner, feeling like I was out of time. I guess it showed on my face and in the way I sat. "What's wrong, Robert?"
"Nothing really."
What'd you do all day yesterday and last night?"
"I went over to Soothsayer's house."
"Soothsayer? Who is that, Chet?"
"Oh, I mean Earl, Mama. You remember Earl. He was one of my classmates at Holy Ghost. That's the guy who called and left that message for me a few weeks ago."
"What's that all about, Robert? Him calling, I mean."
"Just old times, Mama, that's all."
"Well, what made you sleep so long?"
"I guess Daddy was right. I was just tired." Mama didn't believe me, but she wasn't going to push. She knew there was no point. Too often in the past, she had pushed and found herself frustrated by my silence, my internal wall. Instead of going through all that this time, she just asked a direct question. "Why'd that Earl boy call you after all these years, Robert?"
"Just old times, Mama. Earl wanted to talk about some things that happened when we were in high school. He wanted to know what I remembered."
"You know, your papa used to say that about you."
"Say what about me?"
"He used to say that you would notice everything and that you would be a rememberer."
"Papa Raphael said that?"
"Oh, yes, yeah. He used to say when you were still a baby, I would be holding you and he would touch you with one of his big hands and say, 'That's the rememberer for the family.'"
"Really?"
"Raphael used to say it all the time. And he told me, with his meddling self, that I would have to learn to leave you be when you got quiet. He'll just be remembering, he would say."
"I'm going to get something to eat, Mama."
"Oh, I'll get it, Robert. I'll call you when it's ready."
I sat thinking about Papa Raphael. He had watched over me even before I knew it, and it looked like he had been right about me. I turned out to be a rememberer. Daddy came in, and so we three sat down together to eat. We talked and laughed about things from the past. In fact, we were all in such a good mood, I finally told Mama the part of the truth she would understand about the night of Hurricane Betsy. Back then, Daddy had told Mama he had found me out in the yard, just being curious. Now, I told her about walking to J.S. Clark to be with my friends to help them.
When I told her the part about walking out into the storm, Mama was no longer in a laughing mood. Her eyes first turned to Daddy, but then those eyes filled with fire were on me. It seems that even 30 years later, there's some things you shouldn't tell your mother. Soothsayer and Dolores' son had sat with me while I read. They had seen and heard all of my reactions. They had heard me laugh out loud, whimper, cry. They had seen fear come into the set of my body, and seen that fear make me jump at the sound of the thunder and rain outside. They had seen my eyes narrow with confusion and widen with revelation. I finished by reading aloud the last words, like they were the ending of a prayer. Come on, let's go. Exhausted, I closed the manuscript and just sat. Soothsayer got glasses of water for Dolores' son and me. I'm going to go lay down, Soothsayer said. Then he walked toward the back of his little house. I sat drinking my water. So did Dolores' son. He had his mother's short body. He had all of her features, the dark, shiny hair, the thick black eyebrows and lashes. He had her deep, penetrating eyes, that pecan brown skin. Somehow, seeing her in him made it easier to talk to him. I remember the storm. I remember being in it. Lots of the story is true, but some of it seems so impossible. That makes me doubt it, you know. Dolores' son sat watching me. I had that problem too, Mr. Robert. You appeared and gave me the manuscript and then disappeared. I read the manuscript and found it unbelievable, in the same way I thought a lot about your appearance at my office and your quick disappearance. That jolted the memory in me. How do you remember that moment? I asked. Having come back to me now, I remembered it clearly, but I wanted to hear about it from Dolores' son. It was morning, I heard him say. We traveled back to that meeting. As I came to my office in the college's music building, I saw this giant of a man standing at the end of the hallway. I stopped in front of my door and started to unlock it. Wearing a black beret and an ankle-length black coat, that giant, dark-skinned man moved in my direction. I turned to him. With that deep voice of yours, you spoke. I knew your mother in Opelousas, you said, at Holy Ghost Catholic. I have this for you. I have no children. I have no one to pass it on to except you. I want you to read it. I think Dolores, your mother, would want that. There was emotion in your voice when you used my mother's name. That was one of the reasons I couldn't resist starting to read the manuscript, even though this all seemed very strange, especially the way you said goodbye. Oh, yes, yes, I remember. You backed away, Mr. Robert, and then you spoke. Yes, I remember. I said, and whether we shall meet again, I know not. Therefore, our everlasting farewell take. Forever and forever farewell. If we do meet again, why, we shall smile. If not, why, then this parting was well made. And then you just turned and walked down the hall, never looking back, Dolores' son said. His voice was slow and hesitant. I felt as if I had been visited by a spirit, he said. I felt afraid. Afraid about what had just happened. Not knowing what it might mean. I felt lost, ripped from my own world. And I thought you were probably insane. My laughter exploded in Soothsayer's small house. You can laugh, Mr. Robert, but I thought you were crazy. And reading the start of the manuscript made me sure of it. 1965. Everything seemed to change the night Curtis Mayfield was shot and killed on the stage of the Ed Sullivan Show. I read that line and knew something was wrong, because I knew that Curtis Mayfield had not died in 1965. Yes, by the time you gave me the manuscript, Curtis Mayfield was dead. That made your appearance even more spooky, because Mr. Mayfield died because of an unexplained freak accident. Looking at that line about 1965, I was thinking about the fact that a huge piece of stage lighting had fallen on him and left him paralyzed from the neck down. But as you must know, he lived and somehow recorded his last album in 1997, New World Order. And I had, still have, that CD. I was spooked. I knew something was really wrong when I read that statement about Mayfield dying in 1965. Dolores' son was rubbing the tops of his legs again, back and forth. Just slightly, he was rocking his body in the same rhythm. I eventually did some research, he said. I learned that some whites had considered People Get Ready to be a song of black rebellion and revolution. There was some white outrage, but Curtis Mayfield and the Impressions still performed that song on the Ed Sullivan Show without anyone shooting at them. They were dressed simply, black suits, white shirts, black ties, black socks, and shoes. One guitar played by Curtis Mayfield was their accompaniment. The moment had become spiritual as they sang, "People Get Ready." That describes it well, I said, but how? Oh, no, no, of course, I wasn't alive to see that performance on the actual Ed Sullivan Show. But after I read your manuscript, I made a point of seeing and hearing the performance replayed in the film collection in the archives of the Library of Congress. That seems like going to a lot of trouble, young man. Not for me. I'm a musicologist. Music research is what I do. But I think I would have done it anyway because the story had begun to haunt me. It wouldn't leave me alone, even when I tried to forget about it. Dolores' son looked a little haunted now, sitting there, sweating in the heat of Soothsayer's little house. That year, even on vacation with my family, it wouldn't leave me alone. We were down in Florida, my wife, son, and daughter. We went to a seafood festival near Cocoa Beach. There weren't many people there, and the way the seafood was prepared could not compare to seafood prepared the Creole way. But there was a really good local blues band called Buck Barefoot. Buck Barefoot, the lead singer, had a hard, rattling, sometimes scratchy, sometimes smooth blues voice. Tall and lanky, legs spread, rocking from side to side, he sang the blues. Along with Buck were two saxophone players, two lead guitars, one bass guitar, and a keyboard player. I was pleasantly surprised. As I listened to them playing and singing the blues, in my head I started calling them Seven White Guys Playing the Blues. That name came to me as they played a very soulful, bluesy version of Curtis Mayfield's People Get Ready. Here were seven white guys playing a song that all those years ago was considered a song of black revolution. Yet even from them it was a song of revolution, and the way they sang it brought tears to my eyes. Dolores' son rose from his chair. His body short and small, and his movements graceful. He paced, moved over to where Soothsayer had been sitting, stood for a moment, then came back to the rocking chair he had been sitting in. I was being haunted by this whole thing. I thought I should be able to put it out of my mind, especially since I was convinced that you were insane, Mr. Robert. In fact, I thought that until I read the letter from my mother. I stopped laughing. Had he said a letter from Dolores? A letter? What letter are you talking about? I asked. Before she died, Mr. Robert, my mother wrote a letter to me at the hospital just after I was born. I sat in a storm of silence. I was looking at Dolores' son and waiting. I was visiting Dad, he said. I mentioned my strange encounter with you. Dad got this faraway look in his eyes and started talking about my mother. Your mama was dying, my dad said. I knew it and she did too. Lots of internal bleeding from birthing you. And she was talking a little crazy, saying stuff like, it's okay now, I did my part. She said some stuff about stopping the first binder and sealing the seventh seal. She was not herself. Dolores' son had put his head back to talk about this, to speak for his father. His eyes were closed. Then Dad said Mama had asked him for something to write with. She said she wanted to write you a letter, son, and she did. She put that letter to you in an envelope and sealed it, and then asked for her Bible. Then your mama put that envelope in the Bible. I promised her I would leave it there, like she asked. Give it to him when you think the time is right, my dad said she had told him. After telling me this, my dad got up and went into his bedroom and got that Bible and put it in my hands. I opened the Bible and found the letter and a scripture she had underlined. Dolores' son dropped his arm alongside his chair to get his briefcase. Reaching inside, he brought out a Bible. He opened the Bible to the book of Revelation and, showing me, pointed to an underlined passage that read, "Then I saw a lamb looking as if it had been slain, standing in the center of the throne, encircled by the four living creatures and the elders. He had seven horns and seven eyes, which are the seven spirits of God sent out into all the earth." Yes, yes, that we were spirits, sent travelers. But your lives turned out so different, Mr. Robert.
They did, didn't they? But how else could it be? Yes, we had been together, yet none of us had been on the same train.
That seemed to be the way of life. No matter how close you are to a person, to a group of people, you are not on the same train they are on. Somehow we get a glimpse of people. We stand next to them, we laugh with them, we hold them, we love them, but we are not in the same place they are, not traveling the same train. We see them only because at that moment we are traveling at the same speed on trains that run close and parallel with trembling crosswalks we go back and forth on. But in those times we can't see the movement that is their travel on the train they have chosen to have faith in. We only realize it later when the crosswalks between the trains have dropped away and our trains are no longer parallel. We can't see our friends anymore, and so we have to learn about their life through some distant dispatcher. It's just that way. That's why when we are close enough to touch them, we should touch them. They may not pass that close again. I had drooped forward, my head between my legs. I must have looked as if I had passed out. Mr. Robert! Mr. Robert! I sat up. Your mother's letter, I said, coming back to myself. That's a shock. So there really was, is a letter from Dolores to you?
Yes.
Her letter was what convinced me that the story you wrote wasn't just a story. Her letter is why I stopped thinking you were insane, and why I now believe something important happened to the seven.
Do you have it?
He reached into his briefcase and pulled out a folded, yellowed sheet of paper. He handed it to me. I hesitated a long time before I opened that sheet of paper. It took my breath away to see Dolores' handwriting. My dear son, I feel so much joy knowing you have been born healthy. I thank God for that and for you. I want you to know that I love you. I loved you the moment I found out you were growing inside me. I loved you more when I held you and kissed you a few minutes ago. It does not look like I will be with you as you grow up, but I trust that God and your daddy will care for you in love. There is something I want you to know. Life is filled with storms like this one. I'm losing you and you are losing me. That is our storm. Once, not long ago for me, six of my friends and I had to face a very great storm. All of what happened doesn't concern you. No one would believe the whole story anyway. If somehow the story is told, it will be because one of my friends, Robert, will write down what happened. What I want you to know is that for a little while, I had five real friends. Somehow together, we stood in a storm and with help fought and defeated a great evil. Our mistake after that was to stop hoping in each other. We drifted apart before we should have. When we were weak from the battle, we got distracted from who we were together. You probably have already learned that in life friends do come and go, but what I want you to know is that there are times, stormy times, when friends should hope in each other and cling to that hope. Sometimes God is in the circle of friends. That's what I want you to know, my son. Always remember, my son, even though the weather is clear right now, there's always a storm coming. So when the storm arrives, always hope. Hope, my son, is always your most powerful shelter against bad weather. Hope. Never forget that I love you. Your mother, Dolores. I leaned back into the soothsayer's couch and looked across at Dolores' son. I closed my eyes. What was I supposed to believe now? Dolores' letter wasn't really evidence that anything had happened. It was a hint, a clue, a suggestion, a scent. Not evidence, except that hint, clue, suggestion, scent was so strong. It was the same as taking a fork full of etouffee and biting into an unexpected mix of cayenne pepper, crawfish, green pepper, and mushrooms. It was real. It was undeniable. It brought tears to your eyes. It made your mouth water and the whole meal worthwhile. It satisfied you. It made you want more. It was everything you hoped for, yet had been too scared to believe possible. Look, son, I said, I believe that back then something happened to the seven. My problem is that I don't know if the story is an exact description of what happened or just the way I put it together at the time. I don't know. Dolores' son was nodding his head as if he understood. We sat together in silence. It was battle fatigue for me. I had crossed over into a hard place to do battle with a past that I had only vaguely remembered and never fully understood. Now I was fatigued. A passenger who had come to his final stop on this old line train. What are you going to do with the manuscript? Like I told you when I gave it to you, it's your responsibility now. Well, I'm going to try to get it published, but as a novel. I was thinking that maybe people could accept it if it's just a story. Although I didn't say it, that idea seemed right. What I did say was, I need to go home now. My parents are probably wondering where I am. I have one question before you go, he said, looking at me with Dolores' eyes. I saw that article that ran about you in the Opelousas Daily World. You've had quite a life. Yes, I have. Have you ever wondered why your life has been so different from that of your friends, the others of the seven? I wonder that all the time, son. Four of us travelers no longer live at all. Dolores, Iron Horse, Ghost, and Dice. I had been surprised when I read in Jet Magazine of Dice's death in 1996. Yet it had been good to know that Dice was being remembered by so many for winning the 1972 Olympic gold medal for the high hurdles. Word was that there was to be an exhibit on his life in the Opelousas Museum and Interpretive Center. I planned to come back to see that. Still, I was saddened by the death of my friends. Dolores in childbirth. Iron Horse. In Houston, Texas, in a nightclub, Iron Horse was leaning on the bar drinking and talking to the woman next to him. The man on the other side of that woman took offense and let Iron Horse know he was not pleased. When Iron Horse pulled himself up tall and wide, the man panicked, pulled the gun, and shot Iron Horse dead. That at least is the story I was told. Ghost. Ghost had faded away into death by alcohol. I was puzzled, too, by the odd twist that had come into the life of Soothsayer and Kool-Aid. Earl, who was now really Soothsayer, living the life of a recluse and a mystic. Kool-Aid, no one could find. His disappearance from Opelousas had been sudden and absolute, a cool getaway. But to where? No one knew. Yet I know. that it is not the outward appearances of any of our lives that matters. What really matters is the story of how the seven traveled into a storm to fight a battle we did not understand, to help people who would never know. Soothsayer had come out to the living room. I stood looking at the two of them, turned and moved toward the door. Then I turned back and walked to Dolores' son, gestured for him to stand, and when he did, I bear-hugged him. I turned to Soothsayer, who for once was smiling a real smile. I walked toward him, and Soothsayer opened his arms to me, and we hugged. It was a long, hard, and warm hug. Arms and hands loose at my side, I made my way to my car. Even if I am no longer sure of the facts, the story of the seven convinced Dolores' son that something had happened. I too believed that there was something that connected we who were the seven, something that set in motion our short-lived fellowship. We fought a battle together. Throughout what life I have left to live, my certainty and hope is in that testimony and in my remembering something that didn't happen.